What Meyer did immediately when he started the architecture program is he gained commissions, but he didn't view it as his own architectural project. And instead, he allowed his students to work on the project too as a joint effort. And that joint effort embodied his principle of combining a theoretical training with a practical training at the Bauhaus in architecture and design, which was a new way of learning architecture. I'm Dara Kisa, and I teach art, design, and architectural history.
He was only the second choice, but Mats Damm turned the offer down, and it was probably him who recommended Hannes Meyer. At the time, Meyer left no doubt as to what kind of collectivist, cooperative, functionalist design he had in mind. And Gropius thought that was right at the time. This was Thomas Flierl, and I'm Anja Guttenberger, and this is my podcast, Bauhaus Faces. Welcome back to a new episode of Bauhaus Faces. My name is Anja and I'm your host. After the last episodes about the third Bauhaus director, Ludwig Mies van der Rohe, I want to talk in this new episode about the second Bauhaus director, the Swiss architect Hannes Meyer. This one will be another two-parter. However, you have to wait for the second part for a little bit because I will be traveling to Switzerland next week to record, hold on tight, 5 new podcasts for you. In this first part, I will concentrate on Hannes Meyer's formative years and his involvement in corporativism and collectivism, his first steps as architect and artist, and then on to his pivotal role at the Bauhaus in Dessau. The Meyer era of the Bauhaus ended in summer of 1930, when he was dismissed by the magistrate in absence from the school. The political tensions between the far left and the far right in Germany now became palpable. A communist cell had emerged at the Bauhaus, for which Meyer was blamed responsible. His peak in Germany was now beginning to decline, and Meyer decided that it was time to try and establish himself in the Soviet Union, in a country from which he expected freedom of thought and a fulfillment of his architectural visions. Little did he know. The US-American art historian Dara Kisa, who wrote her PhD thesis about Hannes Meyer's holistic education at the Bauhaus, and former senator for culture in Berlin and art historian Thomas Flierl, will help me tell the story of Hannes Meyer in this first part. Part 2 will then focus on Hannes Meyer's life and work after his dismissal from the Bauhaus in the Soviet Union, in Switzerland and in Mexico, featuring the Russian art historian and artist Tatiana Ifusi and Mexican art historian Raquel Franklin, who both wrote that PhD thesis about Hannes Meyer's work in the Soviet Union and in Mexico, respectively. So stay tuned and don't forget to listen to this chapter too. Let's now dive into part 1 of a new episode of Bauhaus Faces and shine a light on Hannes Meyer.
Sicherlich sind zwei Momente ganz prägend. Das ist eine biografische Situation.
2 moments are certainly very formative. The first is his biographical situation, that he grew up without parents in a children's home. He did have parents, but he was sent then to a children's home, so he learned collectivist life from a very early age and kept coming back to it. And the second thing that is very strongly anchored in Switzerland is the cooperative context. And these two aspects, the collective life and living that he experienced and learned about himself and the idea of cooperatives, are 2 very important things that shaped him. His father himself was a master builder, so he certainly had building knowledge. Meyer then went to Germany himself and, like others, learned the trade in other offices and was also involved very early on in joint residential buildings, the Margaretenhöhe for Krupp in Essen and so on. But of course, the encounter and the short time he spent in the Netherlands was also crucial, where he experienced a completely different encounter and affinity between Swiss and Dutch building culture, including the high proportion of cooperative movements in these countries.
Bewegung in diesen Ländern erfahren hat.
Hannes Meyer's background growing up prepared him for the Bauhaus in a number of ways. He, as we know, was a Swiss architect and educator. As a teenager, he started his studies in building trades and architecture like his father. He had very practical training as an apprentice mason and a draftsman. He was also a site superintendent. And so his architectural building experience is varied. He had experience in a lot of different areas within architecture. Even when he got his first professional job, he worked in the architecture studio of Emil Schaut, who designed the KDV department store. And while he was working, he continued with classes in the School of Applied Arts, Kunstgewerbeschule, and also, interestingly, in the Landwirtschaftsakademie, this agricultural academy, where he learned about things in addition to aesthetics. He learned about economics and land reform, and those issues of urban planning will come into his Bauhaus approach. He also, like many progressive architects from all over Europe, traveled to the UK before World War I, where he studied housing reform and the Garden City movement and cooperativist movements. And his connection to Swiss cooperativism was central to his first big building project, where he designed a housing settlement outside of Basel called the Freidorf Siedlung, Freidorf Housing Settlement. In the mid-1920s, he expanded his artistic output when he became involved in avant-gardist artist and architecture groups, including ABC, which was a small group of reform-minded architects in Switzerland, and they published a periodical, like many avant-gardist groups did, to share their ideas and promote themselves. And he wrote for that journal. He published even a manifesto, The New World, in 1926 there.
Stop for a second. I think it's important to shortly summarize the key statements of Meyer's manifesto, Die Neue Welt, to better understand his early years as an architect and artist, so where he came from. One point Meyer highlights is that new technology, including cars, planes, radio, calculating machines, etc., helps reshape the society after World War I. He considers them not only tools, but symbols of a new era, because they eliminate distance, national borders, and old hierarchies, creating a cosmopolitan, interconnected world. The standardization of goods, says Meyer in his second statement, reflects a collective, egalitarian ethos. Meyer celebrates the standard product as a democratizing force, making quality and efficiency available to all. Another crucial point that Meyer is making insists that architecture and design must serve practical, social needs rather than aesthetic or traditional ideals. Buildings for him are, quote-unquote, living machines, shaped by function, economics, and hygiene. The use of new materials like aluminium, reinforced concrete or glass bricks, and construction methods are essential to implement this vision. Art in this context is not about beauty or individual expression, but about invention and controlled reality. Meyer furthermore declares the death of the old institutions and the irrelevance of traditional art forms. He writes that the new world demands new forms of expression. Industrial fairs, grain silos, airports, and mass-produced goods are the true monuments of the age. In his manifesto, Meyer declares the artist's studio becomes a laboratory and art is redefined as a scientific, collaborative process. So you see, Meyer's vision in 1926, just 1 year before he becomes part of the Bauhaus in Dessau, is quite radical and utopian. The past is a burden to be cast aside. The future belongs to those who embrace the means and spirit of their own time. You can find an English translation of Die Neue Welt, The New World by Hannes Meyer online. I will of course link this one for you in the show notes.
Sehr bald kam man auch in Kontakt mit.
Very soon he also encountered left-wing circles with Alizitsky, with Mats Damm, with Hans Schmidt. And I think these were the pioneers who accompanied him for a long time. So I believe that this group formation, which was quite typical at the time, but which also enabled the special communication, gave him the impetus. Of course, the ABC group and the ABC magazine, in which he was involved, were crucial. He also published a magazine edition himself, but interestingly enough, not at all about architecture. So I believe that he was initially much more broadly positioned and that this experience of the avant-garde was only gradually taken up by him, especially after the Freidorf, but the co-op design and this famous room with the bed and the chair, of course, show where things were heading. But I can't say whether he was already architecturally up to it at the time. Of course, the Petersschule is really the point and the League of Nations Palace.
Und natürlich der Völkerbund Palast. Man muss natürlich auch zur gleichen Zeit sagen, dass
at the same time, of course, you also have to say that, like others, such as Le Corbusier, their designs didn't get through at the time, but it was initially paper and design architecture, and basically they formulated a new building culture and aesthetic forms, and it took some time before it was built. Hans Schmidt was always lucky enough to be able to build individual villas for Basel citizens. The school project was realized in a very traditional way, and yet I think it was important for Hannes Meyer that he formulated such a fundamental ethical stance, both his relationship to nature and the question of the circular economy, resource-saving production, the cooperative, the collectivist, that he initially formulated this independently of stylistics, which later also made him open to other approaches, because he was very aware of the discussions in the Soviet Union or his later engagement with folklore or with local building forms, which was very important for him. He later built in Birobidzhan for a Jewish autonomous republic, and even later asked in contact with Ari Sharon. There's a podcast about Ari Sharon online in Bauhaus Faces too. So Meyer asked Sharon, well, what is the national, the local, and even if it is kitsch, but tell me, how do you do it in Palestine, Israel? That is, these fundamental questions of modernity, which were answered in a certain way in the abstract, wide geometric modernism, but at the same time, of course, also excluded the questioning of oneself again. He certainly reflected on that from the very beginning, and that perhaps also made him approachable for various developments. But first of all, we are now in the mid to late 1920s, he's a radical avant-gardist, also writes these famous texts, and is of course exactly in line with the speed and acceleration in urbanization and the cultural awakening that comes with modernization, equalization, gender equality, and of course, he certainly had enormous attractions as a teacher at the Bauhaus.
Enorme Attraktion gehabt als Lehrender am Bauhaus.
He worked on exhibitions and theater performances. He created his own prints, lino cuts. So not only was he interested in architecture, urbanism, planning, cooperativism, but also art, theater, manifestos, and writing within the avant-garde. So it's no wonder that Gropius would turn to him to come to the Bauhaus when he wanted to finally establish a formal architectural program at the Bauhaus in 1927. Even in the press announcement that Gropius published, he mentioned that Hannes Meyer had all of this experience in building and design, from being a bricklayer to a theoretician. He mentioned the avant-gardist performance, painting exhibitions, printmaking, and he also highlighted Meyer's ties with industry and the cooperative housing movement as good training and his ability to be a good spokesman and publicist for the school. So he came to the Bauhaus in 1927 to found the architectural program. Already, Walter Gropius had been transforming the school from an arts and crafts model in 1919 to a more industrially oriented school where students would focus on designs for mass production more so than craft work, handmade goods. And Gropius took the opportunity to transform the curriculum and the structure of the school when they moved to Dessau in 1925, 1926. one thing that I find interesting about Meyer is he is really continuing with the trajectory that Gropius set out, but not everybody liked that. Since the beginning of the school, there were many conflicts, but one of them has to do with the role of art in the Bauhaus model. And many people at the school felt that a turn towards industry was moving away from that original foundation. So building had always been a goal at the Bauhaus. At the beginning of the school, it was arts and crafts in service of building. And yet the architecture program that Gropius had was actually his own architectural firm and his own commissions. And then he would hire students to work on his own projects. What Meyer did immediately when he started the architecture program is he gained commissions, for example, for the ADGB trade union building in Bernau, but he didn't view it as his own commission, his own architectural project. And instead, he allowed his students to work on the project too as a joint effort. And that joint effort embodied his principle of combining a theoretical training with a practical training at the Bauhaus in architecture and design, which was a new way of learning architecture. The year that Meyer was establishing that was also a time where Gropius was coming under fire for his own architectural project at the Dessau-Thorotten housing settlement, the Siedlung. Within that year, Gropius had already decided he would leave the school. Gropius chose Meyer to replace him as director in 1928. To me, that's a sign that he appreciated his work and his approach at the Bauhaus. And that loss of Gropius was very upsetting to many students and faculty.
The student representative of that time at the Bauhaus, Fritz Kur, held a passionate public speech asking Gropius not to leave them behind. If you're interested, you can listen to an episode of Bauhaus Faces about him too. He was only the second choice, but Matsdam turned the offer down, and it was probably him who recommended Hannes Meyer. At the time, Meyer left no doubt as to what kind of collectivist, cooperative, functionalist design he had in mind, and Gropius thought that was right at the time.
Some people had concerns about Meyer leaving the school. However, most people came around and appreciated Meyer's approach. Gropius's curricular changes corresponded to this opportunity presented with a new building and their move to Dessau. In those years of around 1925 to 1927, Gropius was moving away from the traditional workshop model that was how the school was founded and organized, a workshop model based on materials like clay, wood, stone, etc. And he basically modernized the structure to be more discipline-oriented. And so there was an advertising department, an interiors department, an architecture department, textiles department, and still the stage for this very experimental space. Meyer kept those departments, but continued with the trajectory of modernizing to what we now think of as these professions or design studios. Under Gropius's directorship, every workshop was led by two people, a form master who was an artist and a technical master who was a craftsperson. And Meyer streamlined that and had a single instructor. Interestingly, he at least proposed, maybe just in theory, the idea of not having teachers at all at the school. He really emphasized progressive educational models, like from Pestalozzi or even Montessori models of education, of learning through doing, hands-on experience in addition to theoretical training. One of the hallmarks of the Bauhaus under Gropius and Meyer, maybe not under Mies, was a non-hierarchical structure, a less formal environment and more equitable environment. And many students became teachers, etc. But Meyer, at least in the way he spoke about it, maybe took it further. He thought that students learned a lot from each other, and he described a teacherless environment. Oskar Schlemmer actually complained about it. He said, you know, what is this, the new republic of students, et cetera. But Josef Albers, who was also a very progressive educator, he, in principle, kind of agreed with this idea of offering students a field of experimentation, as he phrased it. Anyway, one reason that Meyer wanted to break down that workshop model of having a form and a technical instructor was because he argued that that model was based on this arts and crafts tradition. And Gropius had expressed it in 1923 as art and technology, a new unity. When Meyer came in, he said that art is dead. The artist is dead in this metaphorical way. But really what he was arguing was that design and architecture should not begin with art making, but rather begin with understanding the context and the needs of the client or the people who are going to use the design and architecture. So that shift away from art raised some concern, particularly with the painters at the school, thinking that they wouldn't have a place anymore at the Bauhaus, but also that he was moving away from the original experimental conception of the school and turning it towards something much more professionalized or pragmatic. One of the criticisms of Meyer is that if you remove art from the equation of art and technology and unity, then all you're left with is technology. Critics at the time described that, you know, newspaper articles were talking about in those terms. And I think it, one of the critiques of Meyer has to do with the framework that was established by Gropius, for example, art and technology and unity. But just because Meyer doesn't think that art making should be the inspiration for a design process or an architectural process doesn't inherently mean that he focuses on technology. In fact, he doesn't talk that much about technological developments or new materials for production the way that Gropius did very much, because Gropius felt that the way to design for the public was to focus on new materials, new technologies, and easing production, making the industrial manufacturing less expensive and therefore more accessible to more people. But Meyer, I think by the late 1920s, many of the new technologies and methods had already been established. And so he didn't need to focus on that as much. So instead of focusing on the producer, again, he focused more on the consumer, the consumption. How would this object or building or community be used? So the pedagogical or curricular changes that Meyer made to that end included an expansion of studying beyond art and beyond technology to a more liberal arts education, a broad-based education where students would be exposed to lots of different ideas from psychology and philosophy to art and film and engineering and ergonomics and other organizational business management questions through a series of outside lecturers coming into the school to speak to the students, in addition to hiring some full-time faculty to also focus on things like engineering and organizational management. It's that guest lecture series that is really central to Meyer's shift of the school. Meyer expanded on a guest lecture program that Gropius always had. Part of the school's mandate was to educate the public, but also it needed public support because it was a public school. Particularly in an era of extreme economic distress and ups and downs and inflation, it was of utmost importance that the school have public support. So Meyer not only hired several interesting artists and designers and architects, including Walter Peterhans, who is an important photographer who became part of the advertising department. Meyer also brought into the faculty someone named Franz Riedel, who was a lecturer of applied psychology and was an academic engineer. And Riedel's educational training began in psychology and philosophy, economics, and that all culminated in his engineering degree. And so his background would be evident in one of his public lectures, February of 29, Organization of Work, he called it. And he framed that discussion in terms of psychotechnics. Psychotechnicians are now called industrial and organizational psychologists, and they consider the context of the workplace, including ergonomics, job satisfaction, healthy working conditions, etc. So by hiring someone with a varied background, someone who is looking at human behavior and motivations and things like job satisfaction and healthy working conditions, he is teaching students not only what it is to work in a good architecture firm or environment for them personally, but also to think about their clients in this very complex way. And actually, this is a quote. He says, "Building instruction needs critical knowledge to tackle the entire complex of life. The ultimate goal," he said, "was to study society in order to serve society." And to study society, one phrase that doesn't necessarily come to mind with Meyer is empathy, but he uses the word empathy. And I think that hiring guest lecturers to introduce students to the humanities and the liberal arts, questions of philosophy and psychology, which was of utmost importance, but also human relationships or community organization, etc. He was giving students design principles and a design approach, a design theory that they could then take to any environment and analyze any environment and kind of any group of people or set of circumstances and design for that very specific client. And that is something that I think gets lost in the Meyer discussion, because it would seem as though he is offering a solution, for example, in the Wanderausstellung or in this very simple furniture design. But he only had 2 years to work on that at the Bauhaus. And he talks about and presented to the public through the Wanderausstellung and lectures the fact that it was not a fixed solution. It was a work in progress, always a work in progress and always changing. So Meyer's pedagogy didn't adhere to a fixed system or formula or sort of a top-down model of a centralized authority giving people, this is the answer for all of you. But he also wasn't teaching a sort of a Bauhaus style that had become a little bit entrenched, you know, based on very specific people who were successful, like Marcel Breuer with his furniture or Herbert Beyer with his comprehensive branding and identity that he created for the school in around 1925 to 28. Instead, Meyer talks about a gestalt and a framework of living building, where open active systems and integrative flexible approach, where people could adapt to whatever changes were necessary at the time. And it was an approach that was humanizing architecture and design for the people who would use it, but also for the designers and architects themselves. Meyer introduced his students to building theories that were really comprehensive. They integrated technical questions, economic questions, social questions, although I think I avoid that term because people think about socialism. But with social questions, a different way of framing that would be to say that he was interested in how people would use the space and how that space could evolve over time, for example. Just like with the mobile furniture, this very adaptable furniture that you could receive in flat packs and put together yourself. Meyer's students would consider the use of a home over time, over generations of time, for example, including things like a garden for growing vegetables or the ability to add on another room later when the grandparents move in and the children move out. You know, this idea of adaptability and sustainability. So inherent in the curriculum were topics ranging from urban planning and building organization and budgeting and working with local authorities about building permits and, you know, all of the things that go into building and into architecture and urban planning. And so these kind of social realities that he wanted students to understand range from the individual to the family, to the community, to the local government, to the local businesses, local materials, etc. That concept of design research doesn't come into at least American architectural education until the 1960s, but Meyer was already doing that in the 1920s. So he called this building Lebendiges Bauen, living building. And actually, critics picked up on that, particularly around the Wanderausstellung, where Meyer would give lectures, where he would promote the school's ideas and his own vision for the school in catalogs and public lectures and interviews and, of course, in the exhibition itself. But critics picked up on the words that he used, like elastic and flexible and living building or even unleashed building and festivus bauen. And those concepts of a living thing are actually the 19th century concepts of organic, biological metaphor. But Meyer took design reform concepts from the 19th century and really transformed them into something that we associate with much later approaches. Meyer's cooperativism comes into his structuring of the departments and the interior functions of those departments. In the architecture program, for example, Meyer extended the length of study to 9 semesters, which was the longest course at the school. And within that, the students would study theoretical questions and projects on paper, as well as they would have practical experience at building sites, for example, the ADGB, or an additional building that they built for the Dessau-Totten-Siedlung. But within that department and the other departments, he established what he called a working group model, Arbeitsgruppen. Those groups, or that way of thinking about groups, relates to design studios and how many design studios operate today, with different people working collaboratively, hiring outside experts, performing specific tasks within that group. But in addition to establishing the design studio model, the working groups were also related to Pestalozzi's pedagogical model of learning and training. So there were these groups or this working method, they were interdisciplinary, they brought students and instructors together from different departments to collaborate on real world projects. So, for example, Annie Albers did her diploma project for the ADGB auditorium, where she created a wall textile that would dampen sound for an auditorium, but also reflect light. So it was a very functional project that was implemented at the school. In terms of the architectural projects on paper, these assignments where students would research a very specific set of circumstances, almost the idea being for a specific client. It wasn't just about form and building a cube house and plopping it down wherever. They would study all of these different effects, like the lighting conditions, the landscape conditions, the existing infrastructure, things that we associate often with urban planning, all of the connections that their project would have to everything around it, whether it's in a housing settlement, the distance that noise or smell would travel among neighbors, or distances to recreation. in Hannes Meyer's curricular diagram, it's a series of so many different elements of education that link everything from the guest lecturers to engineering to these business management and organizational questions. And actually, there's a second diagram that links the Bauhaus as a school to the local businesses and local government. So when we talk about Meyer considering the social questions within architecture and design, I think a lot of that has to do with the realities of building or of the business of producing, selling, manufacturing, and promoting a modern way of living.
That modern way of living and the redistribution of the workshops into only two departments, building and interior design, that Dara is talking about, found its peak in a project for the German trade unions. In 1928, Hannes Meyer, and with him the whole building department under the leadership of Hans Witwer, won with a triumphant majority the competition to build a school for the trade unions in a secluded forest clearing in Bernau, not far away from Berlin. They were able to prevail against established architects like Max Taut, brother of Bruno Taut, Erich Mendelssohn and Alois Clement. In their design, they included the democratic thought of equality between student and teacher at eye level, school reform ideals and, above all, the needs of the future inhabitants of the school. Site inspections, demand analysis and diagrams to understand the way of the sun automatically decided the floor plan. The school's structure had to be staggered on all levels and adapted to the landscape. The different parts of the building, school, dormitories and communal living spaces, had to be connected to each other by a long glass passageway. Based on the pedagogical principles of the Swiss educator Pestalozzi, the given unit of 120 inhabitants was divided into smaller and bigger units, two course participants in each room, five rooms with 10 people on a color-coded corridor lived together, ate together in the dining room at a table of 10, learned together in the classrooms, and engaged as a team in sports. The whole school was equipped with the latest furniture design of the time. Furniture that did not fulfill its purpose satisfactorily was designed by the Bauhaus itself and produced by regional trade union-organized craft businesses. In so far, the ADGB trade union school, that is now a UNESCO World Heritage and used as a school for the training of nursing staff from all over the world, was the only public Bauhaus project that was planned and fitted with Bauhaus furniture. Maybe you can already sense that this building is especially close to my heart, and some of you might know that I grew up there in the street leading up to the trade union school. I have been a very active member of the Bauhaus Bernau Association and have helped shape the visitor center on site. The exhibition there shows all of my research about the school of the past 10 years. So if you have a chance, go and visit it. You can even take part in guided tours on the weekends. So I could talk about the trade union school forever without getting bored, but I don't want to bore you. That's why we're turning back to our experts now.
Erstaunlich ist ja, dass er in einer Zeit, als die
It is remarkable that at a time when the KPD, the Communist Party, was running its own trade union opposition and pursuing a radically anti-social democratic cause according to Comintern guidelines, we are now talking about 1928-29, he designed this trade union school in good agreement with the trade union leadership. In other words, his concept at that time seemed to have been strongly orientated towards alliance politics. At least he had a good understanding with the client, and the client was also prepared to adopt such a radically collectivist aesthetic for the trade union school. It was great that basically a left-wing socialist-communist perspective was combined with the best traditions of social democracy, which focused on reform, education, a new way of life, more reformist ideas. So that is a remarkable process, despite all the politicization of his dismissal and all the background to it. I think it was not only a very attractive commission on his part, of course, with a construction office in Berlin and certainly a corresponding fee, but it was also an attempt to realize a meaningful project within the framework of the possibilities of the society with the trade unions, in this case, the social democratic dominated trade unions. You must realize that for a moment. I don't think that was ever recognized in this way, either in the GDR or by the Social Democrats, and it contrasts with the fact that Meyer was then defamed as a communist agitator and promoter of the communist cause at the Bauhaus.
Kommunistischen Sache am Bauhaus diffamiert wurde. Zumindest war es insofern natürlich schon ein Gipfel.
At least in this respect, it was of course a peak, because the production conditions were there. So he was actually able to realize certain limited productions to a certain extent with the shadow and the institution of the Bauhaus. And he later massively criticized the fact that it was only possible at the Bauhaus and that the capitalist bourgeois society could not do this, and that he therefore left the Bauhaus and joined the experiment of the socialist reorganization in the Soviet Union with the hope of being able to be effective on a larger scale. But it has to be said, too, that he had nothing to show in terms of realized buildings in the Soviet Union. So one of the interesting findings in the joint book with Philip Oswald, called Hannes Meyer, Conflicting Interpretations, is that this conversation of the Bauhaus economy generated an enormous income and co-financing, a refinancing of the Bauhaus school, so that the connection between school and production was grasped in a new way that would still be of interest today, that it could be realized on a broader scale, so that on the one hand, planning was close to production and not completely independent of it, and on the other hand, refinancing was possible. The Bauhaus exhibition commissioned by Hannes Meyer, the so-called Wanderausstellung, which toured many German and Swiss cities, also presented the home as an object of collective design and the facilitation of a new way of life, at least within the limits of a society that does not change the basic social conditions, and as a place of self-determination and reproduction. This has an enormous impact and is still a decisive point today. How do we actually want to live? And this always raises the question of living and coming together, of communicating.
Und des Zusammenkommens, des Kommunizierens verbunden.
The Bauhaus Wanderausstellung was a traveling exhibition that Hannes Meyer put together between April 1929 and August 1930. The exhibition was broadly the same, but there were some variations depending on the venue. One thing that he showed was furniture, wallpaper, textiles, and paintings that were produced at the Bauhaus during his tenure, so mainly 1928 to 1930. Part of the goal for showing those products was to build more ties with industrial manufacturers. The venues and the timing sometimes corresponded to big international or national trade shows in those cities. So he was trying to forge or expand the manufacturing partnerships, but also he was trying to find more customers for the Bauhaus furniture that they were producing. And some of the differences in the exhibition or the aesthetics of the furniture were that it was, quote unquote, anti-style. It didn't have a particular signature style, the way that much of what was displayed in 1930 in Paris and in 1938 with MoMA's exhibition. What was, I guess, featured most prominently were Marcel Breuer's tubular steel furniture and a very beautiful installation that was, at least part of the installation, was a whole living space that was a unified aesthetic with Breuer furniture, very modern, sleek, and elegant. What Meyer's exhibition focused on and what Meyer's, what they called the interiors department, what they focused on was less expensive furniture that was mostly made of wood, so inexpensive materials. And the look of that exhibition reminds me of something like IKEA today. There were photos from the Volkswohnung, so the dwelling of the people. And that was an installation with furniture that created kind of a unified room. But in general, the way that the exhibition appeared to people was more disjointed. In fact, at least one critic said at the time that it appeared as if it wasn't a vision for a way of living. Instead, it was a mishmash of different things interspersed together. I thought that was really interesting because some critics accused Hannes Meyer and the Bauhaus at that time of creating a soulless imposition of a singular way of living for all people. But that idea of style was lacking. So it was seen as soulless or anonymous, almost like the dormitory, but for regular people in their homes. But that really missed the point. And part of the point was that the exhibition presented the products and the ideas in a very objective or neutral way. And the idea was that the person visiting could envision their own home space or office space and build that up with these parts like a file cabinet or an extra file cabinet with the desk. You know, this kind of modular way that we often buy furniture now, as opposed to buying the entire set. Actually, that aspect of the exhibition gets to some of the heart of what Hannes Meyer was doing that was different from Gropius. The presentation of the exhibition gets to the heart of Meyer's approach at the Bauhaus, which was to strip away the personal signature style that someone like Breuer had with his furniture, and instead create designs that were useful for the moment and the present needs of that moment. And in 1929, 1930, the furniture was attending to the demands of the worldwide economic depression and also mobility. So adaptability to different circumstances, different rooms, as opposed to a singular entire room, but also furniture that could be dismantled, shipped, moving to different places where people might be moving for new jobs. So the display emphasized the adaptability or the neutral and anti-didactic principles of the period of modernist design, modernist new typography for the graphic design presentation. And so while critics described it as ideologically loaded, I would argue that they had stripped away ideology. And if we look at it from a different perspective, the goals were to give people more choice, give the consumer or the user of the furniture something that could be adaptable to their circumstances over time, and also these individual pieces could be incorporated into their own aesthetic, their own style, their own lifestyle needs. And so this concept of being anti-style or soulless indicates a shift from the earlier arts and crafts model at the Bauhaus, which elevated the status of everyday objects to the status of art making, and emphasize the production side of not just kind of expressing an artistic vision, but also an emphasis on the sort of ease of production or use of new materials. Meyer instead was focusing on the consumer side, what people needed at the time in the circumstances of that time. Some of Meyer's innovations had to do with incorporating or allowing for women to join different workshops. I mean, there were always exceptions to that, but in general, women were ushered into the weaving workshop or the textiles under Gropius. And so in addition to more opportunities for women, Meyer's egalitarianism and cooperative concepts also led him to bring more and more students into the school, sometimes too many maybe, but he also changed the financial structure so that students could have a sort of a work-study arrangement and be paid for their designs or their work within the school, and that enabled more students to be able to afford going to the school. Paul Sturton did an exhibition a few years ago at the Bard Graduate Center where he taught about the new typography. In his essay, he brings up an important point about the Bauhaus, that the Bauhaus was not a professionalized graphic design program, but they were experimenting with a lot of new ideas about graphic design and communications design. That in itself is interesting. When Herbert Bayer left the school in 1928, he himself wrote that the Bauhaus graphic design had become too much of a style. And, you know, I've seen examples where his constructivist approach to the school's stationery and promotional material, yes, it was unified and had a distinctive look about it, but it seemed to be almost a unified style that students would learn and then apply to their clients. And even Herbert Bayer, who was head of the advertising department at that time, he recognized that that was a problem. And so Meyer addressed that problem in these terms of anti-style, as he would say. But instead of training designers to create something that looked modern for any client, he focused more on client-specific work. So on the one hand, students, just like in architecture, could go out and get jobs and adapt to the circumstances of whichever client they need, right? It was more about the client than about their own look, their own artistry as designers, which is the essence of communications design practices today. But also that presented a problem maybe for the school, because then the school seems to have lost its unified identity in the promotional materials. The stylistic elements are sometimes a little bit too boring. And that's one reason why they don't come up in the history of the Bauhaus. Although that's not entirely the case, because Jost Schmidt, who started out as a student and becomes a teacher and somebody who taught typography and taught the four course in form and lettering, as well as sculpture. But in the Meyer period and after, from 1928 to 1932, he taught typography in the advertising department. The work that he did and that his students did was innovative and interesting and quote unquote beautiful as well. But it didn't necessarily have the unified identity that helps establish a reputation or a brand. So that adaptability might have harmed the school's ability to promote their ideas and convey what they were doing in a clear way that people could appreciate. I think Meyer's idea of letting the students be themselves, find their own creativity, work together collaboratively, but work it out for themselves, allowing students to express their political opinions, like with the communist students, that definitely harmed the school and Meyer because he was charged with politicizing the school. And I think that the Bauhaus was already seen as too much freedom for the students and they were sort of running wild. And Meyer did crack down the communist political activity, but not enough in this sphere of public relations. And I think that there's an irony there because he's being an educator and he's letting young people have a sort of egalitarian, non-hierarchical community that Gropius also strove for, but he wasn't able to manage the public perception well enough.
Mit der politischen Schärfe der Kostrufa,
I would think that he could not always have agreed with the political sharpness of the Kostrufra, which stands for Kommunistische Studentenfraktion, Communist Student Faction, at that time. That it was, of course, also problematic for the security of the school when political parties and organizations found such strong expression, which, of course, created the conditions for many of the issues raised there through his teaching and so on. But there are also critical references and articles and positioning from the Kostrufra to Hannes Meyer. And somehow he got involved, of course, because he was particularly close to the ladies of the Bauhaus, to the various ladies, be it the administrative director and chief secretary or the students. And interestingly, the lovers were often committed official or non-official members of the Communist Party, KPD. Thankfully, all Kostrufra publications have now been documented, and you can find a link to that publication in the show notes. But it would, of course, also be interesting to see how the network of communist-inspired actors and activists in and around the Bauhaus also influenced Hannes Meyer. He was obviously totally hooked on the collectivist ideal and even lived through all the conflicts associated with it. But as director, he actually tried to keep it a low profile.
Eigentlich versucht zurückzuhalten. Als dann durch Intrige entlassen wurde.
When he was then dismissed through intrigue, he naturally accepted the role. His first appearances in Moscow, where he lamented the fascistization of the Bauhaus and was greeted as a heroic victim and resistance fighter in large trade union meetings, shows that he then basically accepted the role that was assigned to him in the dramaturgy. And that also helped him for a while in the Soviet Union. So I believe that as director, he did try to moderate the conflicts quite well. But of course, he couldn't stop the social development and the gradual change in the balance of power in society. And of course, it is quite clear that he was unable to control the conflicts at the Bauhaus for any length of time. And obviously, the accusations were largely unfounded. And the fact that the Reichskunstwart Retzlaff then contributed to a settlement being reached, so that he wasn't actually thrown out of the Bauhaus, but instead received a severance payment, also shows that there was a somewhat orderly solution. Nevertheless, there was of course a huge outcry and protest, and it was clear to everyone that a new phase of the Bauhaus was now beginning and would soon come to an end with the Nazis' rise to power.
Bald ja mit dem Machtantritt der Nazis dann auch sofort beendet wurde.
When I was reading about his getting fired for quote-unquote politicizing the Bauhaus, I wondered about what really happened, because the evidence that I was finding didn't correspond to the story as it was written. The main reason that people don't know very much about Meyer has to do with Gropius's writing of the story of the Bauhaus. And we know that he was very, very good at that. He was already writing a parallel story in 1930 in this exhibition that he helped curate for the Werkbund in Paris, where they presented the Bauhaus, basically, as the Breuer, Herbert Bayer, Laszlo Moholy Nagy era of the school before Hannes Meyer became director. So what Gropius would call the high point of the Bauhaus between about 1925 and 1928, when they all left the school. It's fascinating that at the same time as that Paris exhibition, the Hannes Meyer, what's called the traveling exhibition, the Wanderausstellung, was traveling around Germany and Switzerland with the current Bauhaus production. And that has been ignored. The reality of the school was played down by Gropius. It was before he came to the United States, but right at the time that Hannes Meyer was fired is the same time that Gropius was portraying his era of the Bauhaus in the public sphere. And then it continued from there. That story built on itself from there. For example, with the 1938 exhibition of the Bauhaus at the Museum of Modern Art, which played up that same era of the school, ignoring the early so-called expressionist phase for the most part, and then literally ignoring the period after 1928, because the exhibition was called 1919 to 1928. Gropius had come to the United States to teach at Harvard, and Mies van der Rohe came to the United States, and Laszlo Moholy Nagy, Marcel Breuer, and Herbert Bayer, right? All of those most successful, famous designers and architects who left came to the United States, and they were not only focusing on their own contributions at the Bauhaus, but they felt forced to distance themselves from the perceived leftism of the Bauhaus, and particularly in anti-communist US, and as World War II started, where they were the enemies, quote unquote, of the United States. So it makes sense at the time how history can be written with different perspectives based on lots of things, including writing one's own legacy, but also external forces that help shape the story. And what I find and found troubling when I was working on my doctoral research was how those same quotes and references were perpetuated in the scholarship without much elaboration, particularly in the United States.
Well, that was part one of the Bauhaus Faces podcast about Hannes Meyer and the initial years of his career, culminating in his position as director of the Bauhaus and the fulfillment of his ideals in the School for the German Trade Unions. Thank you, Dara Kiese and Thomas Fleel, to make this episode happen. Of course, I will link all relevant publications for you in the show notes and warmly recommend Thomas Fleel's and Philip Oswald's book about Hannes Meyer entitled Im Streit der Deutungen, Conflicting Interpretations, in which Dara published a very interesting article about the role of the FBI in Hannes Meyer's biography. Don't forget to join next time for part two, where we'll follow Hannes Meyer beyond Germany, tracing his work and ideas through the Soviet Union, Switzerland, and Mexico, with art historians Tatjana Efrusi and Raquel Franklin. And if you like my podcast, please take some time now and go to Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or YouTube and like or give a 5-star rating to Bauhaus Faces. And above all, please recommend it to friends, family, and colleagues who might be interested too. For bonus material, you can also follow me on Instagram at Bauhaus Faces Podcast. Help spread the word. And now there's nothing left to say, but tune in next time to a new episode of Bauhaus Faces.